Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with composer George Walker. The Philadelphia Orchestra will include his rarely performed Lilacs in upcoming concerts at the Kimmel Center and Carnegie Hall. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Pearl S. Buck House in Bucks County. This week, the National Historic Landmark Home opens an exhibition that includes the long-lost manuscript of The Good Earth, Buck's most famous novel. And Susan Lewis explores North Philadelphia's Village of Arts and Humanities, which evolved from the creation of art parks on abandoned lots into a community-based performing arts program, including theatre and dance, spoken word and video. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Born in 1922 of West Indian descent, George Walker has been a trailblazer throughout his illustrious career. He became the first black graduate of the Curtis Institute of Music in 1945, earning diplomas in piano and composition. With his debut performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra the same year, he became one of the first black musicians to appear there as a soloist. The composer's almost 100 works have been performed by virtually every major orchestra in the United States and by many others around the world. Walker's Lilacs for Voice and Orchestra consists of four songs set to verses 1, 2, 3, and 13 of Walt Whitman's When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. The elegy to fallen President Abraham Lincoln is one of the most frequently set poems in the English language. But surprisingly for a work of such renown, it won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 1996, Walker's Lilacs has received few performances by major orchestras. However, the Philadelphia Orchestra will feature the work in three concerts at the Kimmel Center next week and at Carnegie Hall the following week. I spoke with George Walker at his home near New York City earlier this week. Let's start off with Lilacs. It was taken from Walt Whitman's great Lincoln elegy. Why did you choose this text and how did it help shape the composition?
I had some difficulty in deciding the text to use, and I kept coming back to the Whitman because I'd never set Whitman before. I've set quite a few poems of Emily Dickinson, and I have a great, great admiration for poetry. And the poetry of Dickinson is so wonderfully controlled in both its essence and its imagery, shape, its length. And I wanted to challenge. Deciding to use the Whitman text, which is free verse, I wanted to feel freer in trying to set a poem that I knew was quite different from any other poem except for T.S. Eliot. The striking thing for me, the real impetus, was the very first line of the poem. There's something magical about the placement of the adverb last, when lilacs last in the dooryard bloom. The placement of that adverb is so extraordinary because it is so meaningful in the way it is placed in that sentence, and it's so right.
How much did you lean on the narrative of the work? Were you constantly aware of what was on the page?
I was constantly aware, as I am when setting poetry, of not just the content, but of the rhythm of the text and the vowels of the text. And so the setting is melismatic, which was to my advantage. And of course other composers have set the entire poem, there are a lot of words, and you have to trip along pretty fast, which means that you're treating most of it in a rather syllabic way. I had the luxury of working, holding vowels and in a way that the singer could almost seemingly improvise on those vowels. So the combination of the content of the text, the rhythm of the text, and the particular way in which I felt that I could create an expressive quality making use of the vowels of the text.
You mentioned other composers setting this poem, noteworthy among them Hindemith.
Yes.
Tell us about the differences between your interpretation and his.
Well, Hindemith was a German composer, and there is, for my feeling, an aspect that is Germanic. And, of course, he set the entire poem.
Well, even in the first line, the fact that you... The structure of the first line is a very Germanic sentence structure, even.
Yes.
That you often find in German music, that because the verb typically comes at the end of the sentence, a lot of the time the music resolves itself by then.
Yes. I wasn't too concerned about what they had done, because I felt that the kind of expressiveness that, for me, is somewhat innate, was totally different from the treatment of melodic lines, the sense of the arch of the line and the harmonic structure. This is an atonal work, for one thing, and that's a major difference. And the poignancy, which has to do in part with treating the lines almost as if they're leader rather than as part of a larger choral context.
There were 50 years between you winning the Pulitzer Prize for this work in 1996 and your composition of the String Quartet No. 1. That's a very long time to be composing. How in those 50 years do you think you changed as a composer?
It's always been important for me to avoid repeating myself, and it's always been important to hear as much music, to learn about what other composers are doing, to fashion my music so that it has an awareness of what has been done, but at the same time that it's different. And at the same time, there are things that have always interested me that may not seem terribly significant to other composers. I've always been interested in aspects of form. And so with works that followed, there's a perceptible interest in the formal content and in the harmonic content, and basically to create works that would be a part of a repertoire, but a distinctive part of the repertoire in that they would not be like other works, and that hopefully they would not be high works that I'd previously done.
Do you recognize the young man who wrote that string quartet? Can you still feel the way he felt?
Yes, I know all of... I can recall all of the details of writing the work, the fact that I had started the work before my grandmother passed and that I finished it after she had passed. I was aware of certain things that I wanted to do for a slow movement that would be somewhat different from your typical slow movement. This movement is, for the most part, a contrapuntal movement with sections that have sort of a chordal relief. But this is not a typical slow movement. And it reflects, in part, the absorption of contrapuntal tactics that had almost a part of my nature when I discovered that counterpoint was, for me, so easy to fabricate and to consider in its integration with harmonic elements.
These upcoming concerts represent the Philadelphia Orchestra premiere of Lilacs. Can you give us a history of the life of the piece from the time you composed it till now?
Lilacs, after the first performances by the Boston Symphony, received only one professional performance, and that was done under duress by the Atlanta Symphony. They had originally wanted to do one movement of my address for orchestra, which had been done in its entirety there when the late Robert Shaw was conductor, And when I objected to the fact that they only wanted to do one movement on a Martin Luther King concert, someone got the bright idea, well, let's do Lilacs. I was very touched by the request from a Curtis graduate, Francis Steiner, who had an orchestra on the West Coast, and she gave a performance with a community orchestra combined with a university orchestra of the piece. And it was very touching because the members of the orchestra were just so concerned about whether they could actually do the piece that it was well beyond the difficulty that they had experienced with other works. And when they pulled it off, there was just this wonderful sense of exhilaration. We did it. And I said, yes, you did, and you did a very good job.
You're clearly a composer who cares deeply about sound. Have you, or can you hear Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Orchestra playing this in your head? Have you spooled through it?
I am so impressed with the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra now, and it's really magnificent. And although I've not yet met Mr. Dutoit, I know that he's very meticulous. I am a little bit concerned because I'm used to hearing the piece, both having heard it in live performances and on the recording that came out, with a soprano. So to hear it with a tenor will be a new experience for me. That is something that I cannot quite imagine yet.
An excerpt from George Walker's Lilacs, the Arizona State University Symphony Orchestra, Faye Robinson, soprano. The Philadelphia Orchestra performs this Pulitzer Prize-winning work with tenor Russell Thomas in performances at the Kimmel Center this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and the following Tuesday at Carnegie Hall as part of Honor, a celebration of the African-American cultural legacy. The program also features bass baritone Eric Owens in Mahler's Songs of a Wayfarer, and two works inspired by African-American music, Mio's The Creation of the World and Dvorak's New World Symphony.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This week, the Pearl S. Buck House, a National Historic Landmark in Poughkeepsie, Pennsylvania, opens a new exhibition that includes the hand-edited manuscript of the 1931 book The Good Earth. Pearl Buck, a longtime Bucks County resident, received a Pulitzer Prize for the novel. This is the first public display of the manuscript since the pages were rediscovered 2 years ago. But as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the book is only one part of Pearl Buck's legacy.
Pearl S. Buck is best known as the author of The Good Earth, a story that traces the fortunes of a farmer and his family in rural pre-communist China. Born in West Virginia to two Presbyterian missionaries, Buck grew up in China, where she lived until she was in her 40s. Written in 90 days, The Good Earth was inspired by her experiences there. In addition to garnering the 1932 Pulitzer Prize, the book helped Buck win the Nobel Prize in Literature 6 years later for her larger body of work. Curator of the Pearl S. Buck House, Donna Rhodes, says The Good Earth was groundbreaking when it was published in 1931.
This is really the first window into an Asian culture that anyone's really ever seen at this point. The area of China is something that people really just have fables and stories about at this point. And here's a person who's lived there for 40 years, and she writes a story. And not only does she write a story, but it's a story that people can relate to and understand.
I first read The Good Earth when I was in high school, 50-some years ago.
Cindy Loudon is a retired high school teacher who volunteers as a docent at the Pearl S. Buck House. As both an educator and avid reader, Loudon says The Good Earth has great value.
For me, it was exposing students on the high school and college level to Asian literature. And I can remember being captured by that because what did I, someone from the Midwest, know of China or Asia at all? Nothing, absolutely nothing. And this was before television and history channels, etc. So you had Pearl Buck's words, and it just was able to take you, to many places.
Pearl Buck's own exposure to other cultures, particularly that of China, helped shape a life dedicated to humanitarian work. She advocated for religious tolerance, women's rights, the mentally handicapped, and children. She had 7 adopted children of her own, and in 1949, she created the Welcome House Adoption Program, originally designed to find adoptive families for biracial children who were considered unadoptable because of their ethnicity. This first international adoption agency continues to operate today on the grounds of Buck's 68-acre Pennsylvania estate, under the umbrella of Pearl S. Buck International, which also manages the Opportunity House, a child sponsorship program started by the writer, and the Pearl S. Buck House, which includes an intact collection of Buck's home furnishings, library, artwork, and literary awards, all open to the public. Janet Mintzer, president and CEO of Pearl S. Buck International, says Buck's contribution to society clearly extends beyond writing books.
Her good work is continuing to make a difference in the lives of people in this century as well as during our lifetime.
The original 400-page manuscript of Buck's most enduring literary work, The Good Earth, disappeared in the 1960s. When Pearl Buck realized the precious pages were missing, she filed a report with the FBI, but the documents never turned up until recently. The daughter of Pearl Buck's longtime secretary found the manuscript in a suitcase in her mother's basement. Curator Donna Rhodes.
I received a phone call from an auction house, and they were interested in knowing if we, in fact, knew anything about it and if we were interested in purchasing it. So after some information that we were able to convey to the FBI, they were able to go in and get the manuscript. And no charges were filed for anyone. There was no criminal intent involved. And really part of the situation is that a lot of the people are deceased at this point. So nobody really knows what happened or where it went.
Although the manuscript had resurfaced, Janet Mintzer explains its ownership was uncertain for a time. 3 organizations in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Vermont all laid claim to the famous author's legacy.
We weren't quite sure if it would belong here because it was left in the house, if it was the birthplace who made a claim that they own the manuscript, or if it was the family trust.
In the end, it was agreed that the family trust in Vermont, formed by Pearl Buck's children, would take possession of the manuscript. But through August of this year, Donna Rhodes says the hand-edited draft of The Good Earth will reside in Pennsylvania on loan from the trust.
This is the manuscript right here. You can see, which I think is really interesting, the title has been crossed off in blue pencil. It was Wang Lung. And her editor said that it just did not pay enough justice to the magnificence of the manuscript. And he suggested the title.
And the manuscript here is in an enclosed case, and it's sitting on the original desk beside the original typewriter she would have used?
Yes, the typewriter is a Royal that she bought secondhand in Shanghai. And it sits on the desk. It's the chair that she used as well. And it's the first time since 1930 that the chair, the desk, manuscript, and the typewriter are all together again.
Rhodes says Pearl Buck was a prolific writer. She's credited with about 1,000 works, including speeches, short stories, children's books, and essays. She wrote 5 novels under the pseudonym of John Sedges. But Buck wasn't content to simply write. Empowered by the success of her publications, she continually took up the causes of disadvantaged groups in society and worked to build greater intercultural understanding. Indeed, when Buck died in 1973, she was buried on the grounds of her longtime Pennsylvania home. But instead of marking her grave with her English name, so familiar to her readers, the daughter of missionaries from West Virginia had her gravestone inscribed with her Chinese name, Cai Zhenju, a lasting reminder of Pearl Buck's international legacy.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. As part of its new exhibition, The Art and Sculpture of Green Hills Farm, the Pearl S. Buck House in Parkersee, Pennsylvania will display the original Good Earth manuscript through August. North Philadelphia was once a thriving combination of factories, working-class communities, and commercial corridors. Yet in the post-industrial age, residents of many neighborhoods cope with abandoned buildings, poverty, blight, and crime. Yet in a pocket of North Philadelphia is a village distinguished by its art parks, with glittering mosaic sculptures and colorful murals. What began as a single art project in 1986 has evolved into a multimedia community arts program that includes theater, dance, video, and spoken word that has altered the landscape and is changing lives. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the Village of Arts and Humanities.
Interspersed among the row houses that hug small side streets, about a mile north of Temple University, a few blocks east of Broad, is art and art in the making. Even on a gray, blustery day, reds, yellows, and blues jump from totem pole sculptures covered with cut glass and ceramic. Colored pieces of tile shine up from the sidewalk, and life-size mosaic angels seem to watch us from the outside wall of a house down the street.
We have the after-school program right here, 2544, that's Germantown Avenue.
Leon Sanford is 17 years old.
And in the back we have, you know, the stage where, you know, when the weather breaks, we do a lot of outside stuff.
Art-filled spaces of all sizes abut the small row homes, seven of which house administrative staff, a media lab, a studio for tutoring, and an education program with dance workshops. Together, they make up the heart of the Village of Arts and Humanities, where Kumani Gant is now the executive and artistic director.
Our mission today is to use the arts to transform the lives of individuals and communities, but to really focus on young people in the community.
Young people like Leon Sanford, who's been with the Village since he came on a summer work program over 3 years ago. He helped organize a hip-hop festival for the community in 2006, does video production in the after-school program, and also does TLC, which in the Village means Teen Leadership Corp.
We're like the teens that everybody looks to when there needs to be a fundraiser or it needs to be, you know, something community-wise. They look to us to basically help plan it and help get everything organized for it.
The Village began in 1986 with an unlikely pairing of personalities. African-American dancer, drummer, and educator Arthur Hall asked Chinese artist Lily Ye to help create a park from the empty lot next to his Ilei Ife Humanitarian Center at 2544 Germantown Avenue. Although she secured a $2,500 grant, Ye had never done this kind of work and had no idea what it would cost. What's more, the landscape architects and other experts she consulted predicted failure.
They all laughed. They say, you're Chinese, you go to that neighborhood. Kids going to destroy everything you build, and $2,500 is a drop in the bucket.
And yet?
It was really a little voice in me said that you have to rise to the occasion, otherwise the best of you will die and the rest amounts to nothing.
Determined to engage the community, Ye went back to Arthur Hall, who suggested she enlist Joseph, or Jojo, Williams, an unemployed man living in a half-abandoned place next to the property.
He heard that there was this crazy Chinese woman on the street and looking for him. He said, well, I want to have nothing to do with this woman.
Ye went to the neighborhood searching for him anyway, once, twice.
The third time he was tying his shoelaces, I said, Jojo, I got to talk to you. And then he was angry with everybody. Everybody was afraid of him. So I didn't go there to battle with him. You know, I went to him. I said, Jojo, I need your help. And that just changed everything.
Another neighborhood man, James Big Man Maxton, came on board. With buckets and water, paint, concrete, and shards of glass and ceramics, Lily Ye, Jojo, Big Man, and a crew of neighbors, many of them kids, created first the Ilei Ife Park, and then, as more lots opened up, another park and another. They created animals, birds, and guardian angels to watch over the community and honor the cultural traditions of everyone involved.
For example, the lions. The lion came from the Chinese tomb guardian lions. They are fierce, but of power and dignity. So Big Man, anything Big Man touch is African in looking, and his grew. So the Chinese guardian lion looks African, and that's really the Village of Arts and Humanities.
The Ilei Ife Humanitarian Center closed, but the village grew. Today there are 17 parks, 12 in the heart. Lily Ye, now retired from the Village of Arts and Humanities, is continuing her work around the globe in places like Rwanda and Beijing. The village, which has won awards and attracted international attention, no longer builds new parks, but the ones in the village heart create a welcoming place for village activities, says village teen Leon Sanford.
This place is like gravity. I mean, everything just flows to it. That's what I believe. So, like, when you get a chance, you know, just wander around. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Graphic designer Alan Jacobson did just that several years ago and found himself playing ball with a bunch of kids. Today, he's president of the board.
I felt sort of welcome in this neighborhood that I wouldn't have imagined would be that engaging. And as I walked around in the parks, there was just something about this place, something had definitely happened here that was meaningful.
And from the start, it was about more than the land.
Now, our first talked about drama is called There Is a Future, written by our own youth today. You know, that's a good thing. I must say it is something...
The village offers programs in dance, theater, and video productions, and hosts community events like readings and video screenings. There was even a small trip to South Africa, where four teens visited a rural community, where people spoke many languages, yet had no running water. These activities, says Kumani Gant, can transform the community's own image of itself.
Because we're located in North Philadelphia, and North Philadelphia has a certain reputation in the media, we feel it's really part of our mission to create a platform for residents to talk about themselves and what they want and what they need and their perspective on the world.
The village commissioned a play, Secret Histories, which tells the stories of five teens, including Leon Sanford.
It's called Secret History because it's told from, you know, different points of view. Life's not really perfect for some people, but, you know, we make do with what we have and we keep it moving.
Community arts manager L. Sawyer has made a film about three kids from the community titled Beirut Boys, because this part of Philadelphia is known to some as Beirut. Sawyer says the community has embraced the village and vice versa.
People are here really, you know, receptive to everything going on, especially something positive, and receptive to any kind of support. Since I've been here, I've probably been to 20 or so court hearings, or I've probably escorted 15 students back to school who dropped out. I don't know if that's been part of my quote-unquote job title, but that's just basically, you know, the role you find yourself in, being in a community where there's 40%+ unemployment rate.
Over 20 years after its founding, there are still boarded-up buildings near the village, still evidence of poverty and blight. Yet success can be measured in other ways.
I think success in the village today is measured by how the teens are affected and how they are growing, not as much by the condition of the building next door.
I'm really interested in what they want, where they want to go.
I want to actually be an editor, you know, a video editor, take an idea and, you know, run with it.
The fact that we're consistently here and consistently on top of everything else we're doing, we're still kind of still a beacon of hope.
The Village of Arts and Humanities doesn't have a post office or a general store or a conventional school, but it offers a sacred place of beauty where young people can come, connect with others, and tap into the creative power of their own lives.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The theatrical production, Secret History, The Philadelphia Story, will be performed at the Village of Arts and Humanities at 2544 Germantown Avenue in North Philadelphia on Friday evening at 7:30. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.